Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Drew Courtney of the group People for the American Way, who talks about a poll recently conducted that found a large majority of Americans support limiting corporate influence in the nation's election campaigns. Latosha Brown of the Gulf Coast Fund for Community Renewal and Ecological Health, who recounts her group's concerns about the health impact of the BP oil spill on four communities across the Gulf region. And Isabel Van Hook of the Council on Hemispheric Affairs, who takes a critical look at the Obama administration's response to the post-coup situation in Honduras. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
A new congressional report has found money paid to Afghan security contractors has ended up in the pockets of greedy warlords and Taliban insurgents. The report by the National Security Subcommittee of the House Committee on Oversight and Government Reform concluded the security arrangements for U.S. truck convoys violated several U.S. laws. According to the Washington Post, the Pentagon has been aware for months that some funds given to Afghan security contractors ended up in the hands of insurgents through third-party payments. The truck routes protected, including those from Pakistan and Central Asia, provide 70% of all goods used by U.S. and NATO troops in Afghanistan. The congressional report comes as U.S. policy in Afghanistan is in turmoil. President Obama fired Afghan Commander General Stanley McChrystal over critical comments made against top administration officials. General David Petraeus, head of the Iraqi War Command, has now taken over military operations in Afghanistan. In June, over 100 American and NATO troops were killed in Afghanistan, the most deadly of any single month in the 9-year war. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton has acknowledged that much of the corruption in Afghanistan is fueled by billions of dollars in foreign and military aid. 2 weeks before British Petroleum's Deepwater Horizon oil rig blowout in the Gulf of Mexico, a toxic leak at BP's troubled Texas City, Texas oil refinery spewed toxic chemicals into the air. According to the investigative website ProPublica, the toxic release started on April 6th and lasted for 40 days. BP now admits 538,000 pounds of toxic chemicals were released during the 40-day period, including 17,000 pounds of benzene, a known cancer-causing agent, 37,000 pounds of nitrogen oxides, which can cause respiratory problems, and 186,000 pounds of carbon monoxide. For years, the Texas City refinery has been recognized as one of BP's most troubled facilities. A 2005 explosion there killed 15 workers. Last year, OSHA fined BP $87 million for failing to address safety problems that led to the fatal 2005 explosion. The Sierra Club says the 40-day toxic leak from the Texas City plant was one of the largest chemical air releases in Texas history. Moreover, local officials in Texas City, a community of 44,000 people, were not notified by BP of the toxic leak until it was over. 10 years after being returned to Cuba in controversy, Elian Gonzalez, now 16, has reemerged as a proud Cuban, a young military cadet, and member of the Union of Young Communists. In a ceremony marking his return to Cuba in Havana with Cuban President Raul Castro, Elian bore no grudge against his relatives in Miami, who refused to return him to Cuba to reunite him with his father. In November 1999, Gonzalez, then 5 years old, was the only survivor of a ship of 14 Cubans, including his mother, who fled for the Florida coastline. U.S. immigration officials ruled that Elian be returned to his father in Cuba. Elian's relatives in Miami resisted and refused to release him. Eventually, U.S. agents raided the home in Miami's Little Havana, seized Elian, and returned him to Cuba. A decade after the incident, Elian insisted, "Cuba is the place I belong." He said, "Today I'm with my father, and that is everything." As for his Miami relatives, Elian noted, "Even though they did not help me forward, they are still my family." But Elian's father, Juan Miguel Gonzalez, now a member of the Cuban parliament, has not been so forgiving of his American relatives. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Liz Becker. Thank you.
A recent poll conducted by Hart Research Associates in early June for the group People for the American Way found that there is widespread concern about the influence of corporations in U.S. politics. The survey also found a strong majority disagreed with the Supreme Court's January decision in the Citizens United versus Federal Election Commission case. In that ruling, the justices, by a 5-4 decision, overturned 100 years of precedents to remove restrictions on campaign spending by corporations, labor unions, and nonprofit groups, declaring these limits violated the Constitution's First Amendment's free speech principles. During his State of the Union speech on January 27th, President Obama urged Congress to pass legislation to reverse the Citizens United decision. To that end, a number of proposals have been raised in Congress to rein in corporate spending on campaigns. They include measures to give shareholders more power over corporate political spending, require companies that pay for campaign advertising to identify themselves, and restrict corporations with big government contracts from buying campaign ads. Some groups are advocating an amendment to the U.S. Constitution that would establish that money is not speech and that human beings, not corporations, are entitled to constitutional rights. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Drew Courtney, communications director with People for the American Way, who discusses the survey results, legislation now being considered by Congress, and his group's plan to ask federal candidates running for office in this November's election to support a constitutional amendment limiting corporate spending in U.S. election campaigns.
I don't think there's really any surprise in the fact that Americans don't like the amount of corporate influence that they already see in their government. If there was any surprise, it was simply how much they didn't like it. Huge majorities across parties, from very liberal to very conservative, Republican and Democrat alike, really feel like there's far too much corporate influence and that there's not enough individual influence, that people don't have a voice anymore. And really, the even more disappointing thing is that people see this as getting a lot worse as we go forward.
You said this cut across party lines and political attitudes of people on the left and the right. Explain a little bit more about how that worked out.
Well, it was just interesting because we asked a whole array of questions about both the system as it works now and how happy people are in it, and whether they think corporations have too much influence or not enough influence, and in the wake of Citizens United, different laws that might be able to fix it, and even a constitutional amendment, and then broke them down across party lines. And what we saw is not too surprising that on the left end of the spectrum, there was slightly more support for a lot of those things and worry about corporations and corporate influence. But looking across the political spectrum, questions about whether or not there was too much money in politics, too much corporate influence, we'd see 3 out of 4 or 2 out of 3 very conservative people who identify themselves as very conservative on exactly the same side as our most liberal, responders. And so really that cut across almost every question we saw. Actually, I say almost, but I can't think of one where we didn't see that, which was really surprising because I think we traditionally think, well, the liberals are worried about this and the conservatives are on the other side. But that's not really the case. On this issue, almost everybody is on the same side of the equation. And hopefully that should be an optimistic fact that we can use to make some real change in the system.
Well, it wasn't that long ago that the Supreme Court came down on a case that really has changed things dramatically in terms of electoral politics in this country. Tell us about the significance of the court decision on the Citizens United versus Federal Election Commission case.
Yeah, this is a real game changer in terms of what it says about how our democracy moves forward and about how corporations have influence in our elections. The court, led by John Roberts, issued a tremendously broad ruling. And what they said is that Congress can't limit influence and how much corporations can spend on behalf of, for, or against a candidate. So they've opened the doors to any corporation, whether that's ExxonMobil or Walmart, spending as much money as they want directly out of their corporate treasury, specifically saying, we should defeat this candidate or we should support this candidate, which if you think about the scale of the money involved, just absolutely blows away anything we've seen in the past.
What are the remedies that are now being debated in Congress? But maybe you could run through each of them, and the ultimate way to confront the Citizens United decision is a constitutional amendment.
The first and foremost is the Disclose Act, and this is legislation that's currently being argued over in the Senate. And basically, it does what it sounds like. It says that anytime there's ads, there has to be some sort of disclosure about who paid for the ads. And in some cases, there's even disclosure if a nonprofit does it of who is funding that nonprofit. And it's actually very complicated because it's trying to find ways so that voters really get to evaluate who's paying for the ad, and you can't just funnel it through Citizens for Happiness to Citizens for Joy and try to cover your tracks that way. That will cover the disclosure part of it, which is, I think, important. I mean, it's one of the things we see now is, I'm so-and-so and I approve this ad. It could be something along the lines of, I'm so-and-so, the CEO of this company, and I approve this ad. There's another bill out there that's the Capuano Shareholders Rights Act. And basically what that says is if a corporation is going to spend money in an election, it at least has to get shareholder approval first. So if you are a shareholder in the company, there would be a vote as to whether or not they could spend that money, which in some ways could slow some corporations down. And as you mentioned, the real way to solve this problem, well, let me say there's two ways to solve the problem. The first is that members of the Supreme Court will change. The Supreme Court can and could overrule this decision. But the real way to fix this is to pass a constitutional amendment, and that's what we're focused on. All the other legislation is very well-intentioned, is very well thought out, but it's quite limited in terms of what it can actually accomplish compared to the literally billions of dollars that are sloshing into the system. They're really just nipping around the edges.
Drew, tell us about People for the American Way and what they're going to be doing from now up until the November elections to try and pressure candidates running for office to take a stand on the issue of corporate influence.
Basically, what we're trying to do is to go out and have conversations with congressional candidates nationwide in the House and the Senate and see if they'll pledge to support a constitutional amendment. And if they do, we want to talk about that with voters. And if they don't, we're going to talk about that with voters. I'd like to say that every senator and every congressman is going to do this because it's good for democracy and it's the right thing to do. But if they decide to do this because it also is politically convenient, I guess I'll accept that too. So public opinion is very much on our side, and we're just going to keep talking about this in every single race, especially where there's a difference between candidates. If one candidate supports it and the other doesn't, we're going to make sure to remind voters over and over again as Election Day comes close.
That was Drew Courtney, Communications Director with People for the American Way. Contact the group at area code 202-467-4999 or visit their website at pfaw.org, where you can read more about the poll on corporate influence. As the British Petroleum Oil League continues to pour oil into the Gulf of Mexico, more than 75 days after the explosion of the Deepwater Horizon drilling rig, about 20 environmentalists and local community leaders met Environmental Protection Agency Administrator Lisa Jackson in New Orleans on July 2nd to express their concerns. One of them was Latosha Brown, Executive Director of the Gulf Coast Fund for Community Renewal and Ecological Health, which provides grants to grassroots groups in the region to promote local organizing and empowerment. The meeting was one of several that have taken place with top EPA officials since the spill, which Brown said was a far cry from the dismissive treatment residents received from the Bush administration after Hurricane Katrina in 2005. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus, who made four trips to the Gulf region after Katrina and interviewed some of the Gulf Fund's grantees, spoke with Brown after her meeting with EPA Administrator Jackson. She said the group's members listed three top concerns: the health effects of the oil dispersants used to break up the oil spill, safe disposal of the oil collected on beaches and oil-absorbed booms, and questions about which federal agency is holding British Petroleum accountable for oil spill damages and protecting residents' health.
Many of the environmentalists and community leaders in the room were very concerned about several things, one being the use of dispersants and the impact, the health impact long-term and short-term on the use of dispersants, particularly since it breaks up the oil, but it gets into the water column, and people are really concerned about what kind of impact that has on the fish and the other wildlife, marine life, but also what kind of impact that would have on people, the people in the environment and the water quality. So that was a major issue. This past week, I know that EPA actually came out with the results of their preliminary testing, but the test actually tests the impact of the dispersants on silverfish and shrimp, and not necessarily in the same kind of mixture of crude oil, salt water, and the marine life that we currently find, kind of the concoction that we find in the waters right now. So there's a major, major concern about this usage of Corexit and the impact that it has on the water quality and the marine life.
I believe those tests showed that when conducted in isolation, Corexit was non-toxic. But I guess your point is that they didn't test the dispersant within the stew that now exists in the Gulf, which includes Corexit and the oil and whatever else is there.
A second major concern was the disposal of the waste, particularly the oil-absorbent booms. So what happens to the booms that are being used that are collecting oil or absorbing oil? And what we found out is that those booms are actually being taken to landfills. Many of the environmentalists, particularly that do environmental justice work, are very concerned about some of the oil booms will wind up in landfills of fence line communities that are already vulnerable, and most of them are people of color, are communities of color, low income communities of color that have been not only taken advantage of, but have been the most vulnerable. So now you're adding another potentially very toxic element to these fence line communities that have already, in many of the areas, the toxicity is so bad that it's known as Cancer Alley. Particularly, there's a corridor in southeast Louisiana. So there was a lot of concern about where those booms will be placed or disposed of.
Latasha Brown, let me stop you there for a minute, because I've been to St. Bernard Parish, just east of New Orleans, and I've seen those fence line communities. They're butted up right against huge petrochemical plants. But please, for our listeners, explain that term a little bit more, fence line communities.
Fence line communities, those are historical communities that have been usually they're working class communities, most that are based throughout the region, but they're huge industrial, particularly in the petrochemical industry, that are right basically in their backyard. And there's been a long-standing fight, particularly in the environmental justice movement, of holding these industrial companies and petrochemical companies accountable, and that many of these companies actually take advantage that these are working class communities of color, and they exploit the situation in terms of purposely locating in areas where they feel that the politics may or may not be as strong as in other communities that are far more resourced.
Did those of you who just met with EPA Administrator Lisa Jackson have any other top concerns?
Yeah, the third concern was who is enforcing BP. You know, many of the communities felt that the EPA's role is to protect to be the Environmental Protection Agency, so to live up to its name in terms of making sure that it protects the interests of communities from environmental hazardous circumstances and environmental hazardous incidents. And there was a lot of concern that it appears that BP is operating in many ways like a super state, and that instead of the government agencies holding BP accountable, BP is operating in a way that they're basically informing the government and informing us of what it is that they intend or they plan to do. So there was a lot of concern about the enforcement issue in terms of who is holding BP accountable. What we were kind of informed with EPA is that the Incident Command Center is actually where the buck stops, that the Incident Command Center actually is controlling and is the agency that is overseeing this process. But there was a lot of concern, particularly from the environmental groups, that in some way there's a need to see more enforcement and more enforcement of BP in a clear line that our environmental, ecological, and health issues are being protected and BP is being held accountable.
That was Latosha Brown of the Gulf Coast Fund for Community Renewal and Ecological Health. Contact the New York office at area code 212-812-4361 or visit their website at gulfcoastfund.org. It's been 1 year since Honduran President Manuel Zelaya was forced into exile in his pajamas by the nation's military, acting on behalf of the Honduran Congress and Supreme Court. The coup d'etat follows Zelaya's decision to hold a non-binding national referendum on establishing an elected National Constituent Assembly to rewrite the nation's 1982 constitution. After Zelaya's removal from office on June 28th, grassroots organizations mobilized to protest the coup, which unleashed violent repression by the army under orders from the regime's de facto president, Roberto Micheletti. The Organization of American States, or OAS, representing a new wave of progressive governments across the hemisphere, expelled Honduras until democracy was restored. Initially, President Obama opposed the coup, but over succeeding months, his administration undercut multilateral negotiations to return Zelaya to office in order to oversee the scheduled November presidential election. With U.S. support, the election campaign was held as the army shut down opposition radio and TV stations, tortured and killed anti-coup activists, and arrested thousands of protesters. Most governments around the world rejected the legitimacy of the November 29th election, whose winner was Porfirio Lobo, a conservative businessman with links to those who organized the coup. Now, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, on behalf of the Obama administration, is pushing the Organization of American States to readmit Honduras, despite the fact that opposition organizations, activists, and journalists continue to be targets of repression and assassination. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Isabel Van Hook, a research associate with the Council on Hemispheric Affairs, who talks about her recent article, Washington Strikes Out on Honduras, which examines President Obama's failure to depart from the Bush administration's often criticized policies relating to Latin America.
The OAS, the Organization of American States, unanimously voted to suspend Honduras from the organization following the military-led coup on June 28th of Manuel Zelaya. The entire inter-American community took a hard stance against what happened, the overthrowing of a democratically elected president. But since then, the U.S. has Secretary of State Clinton has led initiatives to attempt to bring Honduras back into the OAS community. And Clinton is mainly getting support from Canada and the majority of Central America, but the rest of the inter-American community is resisting her initiative to recognize the new Honduran government under Porfirio Lobo Sosa, who was elected in last November and put in office this January.
There are many observers of that election, which occurred under the direction of an interim president that took over after Zelaya was kicked out in the military coup. And there are many deals that fell through that would have put Zelaya back in power to oversee those elections so they could at least have a chance of being free and fair. But that never did occur.
First of all, I think that it's important to point out that the interim leader, Micheletti, had agreed, along with initiatives led by the U.S. and Costa Rica, with the signing of the San Jose Tegucigalpa Accords, that the Honduran Congress would agree to reinstate Zelaya after a favorable vote so that he could finish his interrupted term. And about 3 weeks before the elections were held, the Assistant Secretary of State, Thomas Shannon at the time, announced that the United States would recognize the results of the November election even if Zelaya were not reinstated. And earlier in July, immediately following the coup, the OAS resolution stated that the inter-American community wouldn't recognize any government that didn't include Zelaya's participation. And so the United States changed that stance and went ahead with recognizing the results of the November election. Beyond that, the elections were also somewhat questionable based on certain human rights violations committed under Micheletti's regime. And there was a pattern of repression and threats and violence against those who weren't supporting the coup and those who were supporting the return of Zelaya.
How was the Obama administration's moves on Honduras after the coup, how is that viewed around the hemisphere, around the other progressive governments all over Latin America?
I think what's most unfortunate about the U.S. policy stance in this case is that it's become another issue of, you know, are you with us or are you against us? It's taken something where, following the coup, the entire inter-American community immediately moved forward, suspended Honduras's membership in the Organization of American States, and it was truly sort of a multilateral effort. And now the United States is sort of taking a heavy hand and trying to push a policy line through the OAS that isn't coming from, you know, a majority of the OAS members. I think that most of Central America, except for Nicaragua, is sort of stepping in line with U.S. policy. Canada is sort of stepping in line with U.S. policy, but other major hemispheric players like Brazil, Argentina, Venezuela, Colombia, and Mexico don't support the U.S. policy and don't think that Honduras is ready to return to the OAS, because it sort of, you know, justifies the precedent that, you know, you can sort of hold what seems like elections, move along, and everything will be fine. You might get a slap on the wrist, but that's about it. And here's an opportunity for the hemisphere as a whole to act in partnership, and that's sort of what the Obama administration was espousing, a new partnership with Latin America, but it's sort of coming back to the U.S. decides what the policy will be, and you either are pro-U.S. or not.
Many of the Latin American nations have not been very happy with the actions of the Organization of American States over the years, and particularly the domination of the United States of that body. And the so-called Rio group has been meeting since 1986, but it looks like in their recent summit in Cancun, Mexico, that they're moving really to establish a rival or an alternative to the Organization of American States that would exclude membership of the United States and Canada to make it exclusively a Latin American group. Any observation about where that might be headed?
Yeah, I think that it has potential to sort of be a regional cohesive. I think that the United States will always exert an extensive influence over the hemisphere, and especially over the, you know, the countries it has in its pocket. I don't think Mexico will really do anything to oppose majorly any of our big policy agendas. I think it almost might be better. I think that to have sort of a balancing force within the hemisphere. I think that the U.S.'s relationship with Latin American countries in the hemisphere has sort of always been an afterthought, and Brazil is definitely taking a larger role, not only in the hemisphere but in the global arena. And I think that maybe it'll make the U.S. sort of wake up and pay attention and realize that it has to start acting more as a partner with Latin America and the Western Hemisphere rather than sort of as, you know, the captain on the ship.
That was Isabel Van Hook, a research associate with the Council on Hemispheric Affairs. Visit the Council's website at COHA.org to read Van Hook's article, Washington Strikes Out on Honduras. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-268-8446 or write to Between the Lines, care of Squeaky Wheel Productions, P.O. Box 110176, Trumbull, Connecticut 06611. Visit our website at btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Liz Becker, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.